come back tonight to Abraham, you wonder, well, what does Abraham have to do with Christmas? And obviously, Abraham came along a long way before Jesus came. But there are things about Abraham that show us the love of God that leads up to Christmas time. And as I've said over the last several Sunday nights, we looked at Abraham. The covenant that God made with Abraham is a great thing for us to know about and to understand and to deepen our faith and to celebrate the hand of God. There are two great promises that God made to Abraham in what's called the Great Covenant. The promise of many descendants, which would have seemed like an impossibility to Abram, and that God would give him and those descendants, really give his descendants, their own land forever to live on. And so when we think of the Great Covenant of Abraham, would you go on to that next slide there, Lillian? The two great promises of God, the descendants and the promised land, and both of them are so important to understand how God works through time, how God works through the Bible, and is looking forward to the time that Jesus came. Last week we came in the story to the part of the story where Abraham says to God, "You have given me no children." We don't know exactly the tone of Abraham's voice. It certainly is not disrespectful, but Abraham is pouring out his heart to God. And last week we read about how Abraham was able to be honest with God. And when Abraham was disappointed or afraid or didn't know what was happening, Abraham's a great example of someone who just absolutely talks to God and says, "God, I believe in you. I have respect for you." He uses that term, "O sovereign Lord," and then he pours out his heart. And so last week we read that part of the story and how God had not given any Abram children yet. And God takes him outside. And the last thing we looked at last Sunday night is God takes Abraham. And he says, "Abraham, get off your cot." And in the middle of the night, he had this vision and said, "Go outside your tent and look up at the sky." And then the amazing thing that God said next is, "Abraham, as the stars are in the sky, so shall your descendants be." Let me read, starting with chapter 5 of Genesis chapter 15. I'm going to read to the end of the chapter again and pick up where we left off last week. Genesis chapter 15, verse 5. It says, "God took Abram outside and said, 'Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' Then he said to him, 'So then shall your offspring be.' Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. He also said to him, 'I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it.' But Abram said, 'O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it?' So the Lord said to him, 'Bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon.' Abram brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. Then birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure.' When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, 'To your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites.'" You try to imagine what the sky must have looked like to Abram that night as he went out and he looked up and he saw the amazing white specks and dots of a sky 2,000 years ago that I'm sure was not where Abram was at anyway, would not have had any city lights. And you know the difference between going out and looking up here in Mifflinburg and going up on the mountain and looking up at the sky and how beautiful it is. I did have the opportunity to spend one night in the Jordanian desert across the border near Petra when I was there it's a couple of years ago now. And one of the neat things is we slept out under on mats on the sand, kind of at the bottom of a mountain, and looked up in the sky. And it was amazing, the beautiful white of the sky, for Abram to imagine what he saw then. I mean, when we have the opportunity to go somewhere, we don't go very often away from civilization, and we look up in the sky, we're amazed. And imagine what Abraham must have thought that night as he was looking up at the sky, and he could just see, I'm sure. And God says to him, count the stars if you can. Know that, Abram, your descendants are going to be like these. That's a beautiful picture. Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And then the next four words to me of the chapter are equally amazing. And key to understanding why Abram was so close to God, and why it was that Abraham was so great in the eyes of God and great in the eyes of man. When you look at his influence then, over three world religions since then, and his influence, how great this event and this night and this revelation, this covenant is to God and to Abraham. Why it is that Abram was so great in the eyes of God and so many other people. Four words that are really defining of who Abraham was. Simply, Abraham responds to this great picture that God gives him. I mean, God's a good storyteller. He's a good illustration maker. And look up at the stars, and how does Abraham respond to that? Why is it that Abram is just seen as this great man? Well, he responds with four words. Simply, it says in the next verse, Abram believed the Lord. Abram believed the Lord. What an amazing thing to believe. I mean, here's this man who's nearly 100 years old, and he had hopes of having children, probably ever since he and Sarah were together, and he's now almost 100 years old, and there's not any text or anything about the story in between the time that God says here to him, Abram, your offspring will be like the stars of the sky. It says in the next verse, and Abram believed the Lord. There's something about Abram that made the choice of faith, and immediately he responded and believed the Lord. I mean, this is simple faith. When you talk about faith and great faith, the greatest faith out there is simple faith. And Abram has that, gives us that example. He believed God for what God said, and it was credited to him for righteousness. Simple faith, believing God for who he is and what he says. And God responded to the simpleness and to the very basic heart response of Abram. I notice here that it doesn't say Abram said anything, but he simply believed the Lord, and God knew his heart, and God knows our heart. He knows our heart. He knows where we're at. He knows where we struggle. He knows what it is that we wrestle with, and he knew Abram, and deep in Abram's heart it says he believed God, and he credited to him for righteousness. God rewarded Abram's amazing faith, and he credited it to him as righteousness. There's some kind of link between faith and righteousness, believing and righteousness. Faith is a verb. It's not just a mental assent of something, but it is to actively put yourself in the place of believing and responding to what God has revealed. That's what faith is. Faith is a verb, and Abram had that kind of faith, and God said he credited to him for righteousness. Looking ahead and thinking about how God defines faith throughout the Bible and other places, in Hebrews chapter 11, this story, this moment in Abraham's life where God tells him to go out and look up at the stars, and very simply, Abram believed. And how significant that is to understanding who Abraham is. In Hebrews chapter 11, in the faith chapter, this story comes up again. Listen to what the writer of the faith chapter says about Abram. It goes right back to the story. Chapter 11, verse 11 says, by faith Abraham, even though he was past age, and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. I mean, here it is, 2,800 years later, the book of Hebrews is being written, and what is remembered about Abraham is that he considered him faithful who had made the promise. Abraham, before there was such thing as a Bible, an Old Testament, a scripture, the written word, believed God, and that's an amazing picture. Believe the Creator. He believed in the Creator. Also in that chapter, and a little bit earlier in the chapter, it says, here the definition of the kind of faith that pleases God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, for we must believe that He is, and He is a rewarder of those that diligently seek Him. There's two elements of faith, and Abraham shows them both, and that's what God calls of us. First, to believe in God, to believe that He's real, to believe that He exists, to make the choice of belief of the existence of God. Those of us, maybe, that have been around faith for a long time, maybe around teaching, maybe around church, that's kind of a given, you know, although that's not always true. Sometimes we might have doubts, we might have things that we don't understand and really challenge our faith, or difficult times, and that's true too. So I don't mean to overgeneralize and say just all of us have no trouble believing in God. I mean, hopefully that's not our battle constantly, but most people go through a time of deciding, do they really believe in God? Do they take that step of choosing to believe? But that's only the first half of faith. The second half of faith is believing that God rewards those that diligently seek them. It's translated in a different way, to those that God calls. To have faith in God is to believe that God will do what He says He will do. Abraham had both. He believed, he considered Him faithful, and he also believed that God could and would do what He said. He didn't understand how it would be. It seemed impossible to him, and that's how he responds to God. I don't know how, you know. I don't know how you're going to do it, God, but yet he had a deep and profound faith that God could do and would do what he said he would do. And so God, again, responds to this faithful response of Abram, and he gives him a second blessing, a second promise. The second promise is the promise of the land. And that, too, is equally with the first, an amazing promise that God would make to a 100-year-old man that had no children. I mean, to say that this land is going to be filled with your descendants. I mean, Abraham, at 100 years old, I'd imagine he might have thought, well, man, God's amazing. If he can give me a child, wouldn't that be something? Sarah, wouldn't that be something if we had a baby? You know, you just imagine, you know, how his faith could have, you know, well, maybe God could do it, but then you're going to fill the land. As the sand of the seashore and the stars in the sky, Abraham, you're going to have descendants. Imagine the kind of faith that would take and how amazing it must have been. And God could just see how one step at a time Abraham believed God. I mean, he just believed God one step at a time. He didn't know how, he didn't know when, he didn't know where. He didn't have any of that plan ahead of time, but God says, you're going to have descendants at 100 years old like the stars, and you're going to have all this land. And at this point, he probably, well, you know, what land? He may have understood maybe culturally, or maybe there was something behind that we don't know and see, but so far, God hasn't spelled it out. Toward the end of this chapter, though, he does tell him, and then it kind of comes together, the promise of the land. But you look at God's response. God says to him, he also said to him in verse 7, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it. I mean, God reminds Abraham here. He says, Abraham, 25 years ago I called you. I told you to leave the land where you were at. In fact, you go back a couple chapters, we don't read of the time that God called him out of Ur. We read of the time that God called him from Haran. But it was Abraham's father who made the journey with his son and their family to Haran, 700 miles from the Ur of the Chaldees. And then God called Abram when he was in Haran. And And God says, I'm the same voice that called to you 25 years ago. Abraham, you remember that 25 years ago when you know that a voice called you to get up and go to a land that I would promise to you? I'm here again. I'm reminding you of that promise. I'm reminding you that 25 years later, I don't know if you think back to 25 years ago in your life, what was going on in your life and what was significant in your life. Some of you can't think back that far, I know. Those of us that are a little older, 25 years ago, I'd have been 28. Wow, Debbie and I were married. I just felt a call to preach. I was going to seminary. Wow, 28 years ago, or 25 years ago. I think back to the time when God called me to preach, when I think of that time frame and how there was a day in my life, and I remember God very clearly coming to me and saying that I was to be a preacher. And for me, that was a life-changing time in my life and moment. But for all of us, think back 25 years ago and the hand of God over time, and the same God that maybe spoke to you in your childhood as a teenager, who saved you, who brought someone into your life, and all the things that happened in your life and worked in your life and redeemed you and forgave you and gave you life in Him. And whatever your journey is, I mean, we all have a different journey, what we came from, what we went through, our decisions and all those things. But the same God who called to us with His love and His grace at one time in our lives, the same God today that will speak to us. And when I read this verse, I think of that faithfulness of God. I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it. God reminds Abraham that He is the same God who spoke to him that first time. God had said, if you look back a couple chapters, God had said, I will show you a land and make you into a great nation. I mean, that was quite a promise right there. I will make you into a great nation, although it doesn't, at least in that paragraph, it doesn't say how. It doesn't really describe descendants. It just says, I will make you into a great nation. I guess that would have probably been to Abraham a promise of children. At the age of 75, having lived probably a little bit less than his expected, about half of his life, Abraham might have 25 years ago thought, well, wow, God's called me from our family, from Ur, and He's about to do it, you know. But still, 25 years later, God, he still hasn't seen the promises of God being fulfilled. Whatever that, when he said back there 25 years ago, I'm going to make you into a great nation, Abraham probably, well, man, if that's what you're going to do, God, then I'm part of it. I believe in you. And he made the trip down to the promised land, and he went to Egypt, and then he came back. And, you know, all the time now has passed 25 years, and God comes back and says, I'm the same God that was back there in Haran, and I called you to come. It might have seemed impossible to Abram. This whole series of promises, the covenant that we're describing tonight, had to have seemed impossible to Abram. But even more so 25 years later, you know. If God would have done that when he got there the first time, I think it might have been easier for Abram to believe. But for 25 years of not knowing and not seeing how God was going to work it out, Abram continued in that time to have faith in him. And it would seem even that his faith grew stronger and stronger. I do realize that sometimes our faith is tested more in the difficult times and those times in between, those mountaintop experiences when we're not sure, is God still there? Does he remember me? Is he with me? Is he speaking to me? Well, for 25 years, Abraham kind of went through that time, and God reminds him, 25 years ago, I spoke to you, and I'm coming, I'm speaking to you again. The reminder of God's faithfulness in the past gives Abram more to hold on to and trust for the future, that God will continue to lead him and speak to him. And for Abraham, his life is just filled with these experiences of God coming to him and working in his heart and his life in amazing ways. And then in verse 8, Abram responds. He says, but Abram said, O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? I just said how great his faith was. I just said how amazing it was that he could trust God for such things that seemed so impossible. And then verse 8 almost sounds like, well, he's backing up a little bit. O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? Maybe Abraham as strong as his faith is, he seems to ask God for a sign. God, would you show me? Would you confirm for me? Would you make sure I got this right? You know, I had this sense with Abraham that maybe it was almost too much for him. Descendants, as the stars in the sky, this land and a nation. I mean, Abraham was a great man of faith, but he was human. And he wasn't divine. And though we paint him in all these marvelous ways, we're reminded that Abram is like us, human. And he had challenges to his faith too. And there were times when Abraham certainly didn't understand the hand of God. But yet Abram, in the midst of that, had that ability to respond and be obedient to him. And he asked God in this time for a confirmation. Maybe he felt uncertain. Maybe he felt confused. Maybe he just really kind of had that thing in his heart and said, God, did I hear you right? Will you say it again? Did I really hear what you said about the land and about descendants? And it's like Abraham said, this is pretty important. I don't want to mess this up, God. Would you just come one more time and say this to me? And would you just help me to be sure? That's a sense that I get from this story. Did I really hear God right? Abraham had incredible faith, but he wasn't Superman. He was very human. And I see in his story, like us, there are times when probably it's easier for us to have faith and have a strong belief that God's in charge and trust him. And then there's times in our lives when we feel like we're not sure. And we wonder, is God there? And what's God saying to me? It may be that we don't have the doubt that God's there sometimes. I mean, we can believe that God is, but believing that God's speaking to us is another level of faith. And maybe that's where Abraham was. He didn't doubt God's existence. In fact, he says, "O sovereign Lord," he shows both a belief in the existence of God and respect for God. But O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? I mean, God, are you sure that this is what you're telling me? And I think in Abram's response to God, we see the humanness of Abraham too. Perhaps he's like we are sometimes when we're not sure. We want to believe. It's not that we're doubting that God's a good God, but we don't understand. We don't see why. We don't know why he does certain things at certain times and not other times. I wonder if Abram could be much like we think of the man Gideon from the Old Testament. There's several stories in the Old Testament where people of God, who God called and God had a plan for, they said, God, I know you told me this, but would you just say it again? Would you just show me? Would you give me a sign? Would you just confirm with me so I know for sure what you're saying is right? I think of Joshua, that happened. And we think of a man named Gideon. And stories from Gideon's life where he said, God, I don't know why you're calling me. Man, I'm the puniest of my tribe. Why do you want me to go out there and win this battle? And Gideon kind of has this struggle with God. Listen to this story about Gideon and Joshua, or Judges chapter 6, and how he says to God, God, would you show me a sign? Would you just be sure to come again and show me? Judges chapter 6, verse 17 says, Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you. Gideon says, I'm almost sure. I mean, I'm sure, but I'm not sure. But God, would you just stay right here? Don't move. I'm going to go and I'm going to get the animal sacrifice to show you how sincere I am. And I'm going to bring it and I'm going to prepare a sacrifice. Don't leave, because I want to show you first how important this is to me. And God, would you please hear and hear my heart and receive my sacrifice and then confirm for me. And the Lord said, I will wait until you return. That's something, how God just talks to Gideon and Gideon talks to God. And it's a reminder again of how God wants us to talk to him about our faith issues and our struggles. It's okay to talk to God about it. It's all right to come before God and say, God, I need to hear from you. Gideon went in, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah of flour he made bread without yeast, putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot. He brought them out and offered them to God under the oak. The angel of the Lord said to him, take the meat and unleavened bread, place them on this rock, and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Oh," listen to the next two words, "Oh, sovereign God," the same words that Abraham used. He exclaimed, "Oh, sovereign God, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." I think of Gideon and how he wanted to believe, and he was trying to believe, but yet he just asked God for a little bit more. I think of the New Testament. I think of one of the men that came to Jesus to heal his son, and his words kind of always have kind of struck me. The father in Mark chapter 9, when he comes and says, "Jesus, can you heal my son?" And Jesus says, "Do you believe I can?" And how does the man respond? He says, "I believe." Then he says, "Lord, help my unbelief. I believe, but Lord, help my unbelief." And that's probably where we are sometimes in our faith. We do believe. We do believe that God is real. We do believe that God is just and righteous. And yet there's somewhere a part of us that struggles to really be sure, to really see Him. We want to see the sign. We want to see and hear His voice. And sometimes one of the things about faith is we have to wait on that. We have to pray and ask God, and God will respond to us in His time. Sometimes it's in the quietness of the response in prayer. You've probably had times in your life where you have had something that you've really wanted to hear from God about, and you've cried out to God, and God's answered your prayer, maybe right then, or maybe the next day, or maybe in the peaceful quietness of some moment, or somehow God comes and speaks to your heart in your life. And there might be some things in your life when you've had to wait longer. Here Gideon didn't have to wait very long. Abraham waited 25 years, and then he'd wait longer. In fact, it challenges faith later, because even after all this, he still didn't have a son. So he takes things in his own hands, and Sarah does, and we'll come to that story. But how sometimes our faith is like that. We believe, but yet God help our unbelief. And I think it's a good prayer for us to ask. I think that's a good prayer to say to God. God, I believe, help my unbelief. I'm taking this step of faith. I am giving you, God, what I have. It's that little mustard seed of faith. I'm not doubting you, but I'm asking you to show me deeper. I'm asking you to show me your heart. I'm asking you, God, to come further for me. I feel like that's what Abraham was saying here when he said, "But how can I know this, God? How can I know that I can gain possession of the land?" Abraham asked for a sign. Once again, he uses that term, "O sovereign Lord," out of respect for him. And what we have after Abraham asked for a sign is we have an amazing story of an ancient practice of something that probably, unless we lived back there, this seems to be a very unusual thing that happens. And wow, we just kind of wonder the context of it and the culture of it. But what we have is an amazing time, an ancient practice by which a covenant was confirmed between two parties in the Old Testament days. And we see the two sides that come together, and then the covenant is made. The covenant is agreed on. It's a binding of the covenant. First, there's the sealing of the covenant, and then the binding of the covenant, an ancient practice by which two parties would pledge themselves to each other. And in this covenant, this is a one-way covenant. God is promising Abraham descendants and land. Abraham also is affirming his part by the faithfulness, and we see that throughout the story, but this really is a one-way covenant with Abraham. "Abraham, I've chosen you based on who you are, based on what I know, based on what you've already done, based on your response of faith. I am going to promise you two things, descendants as numerous as the stars in the land." And so this covenant really is a one-way covenant. Over time, there have been different ways that mankind have expressed the sealing of a covenant. And different symbols have been used when one party makes a promise to another, or that two parties make a promise together. I mean, you just think of those of you that have a wedding ring on. What is that? That is a sign between two people. It is a covenant sign. It doesn't make you married. It doesn't keep you married, but it is a pledge between two people that you exchange in your wedding that says, with this ring, I thee wed, and I make a promise to you of eternal faithfulness. Well, this practice of what we read in this chapter is like something like that, and happened a long time ago. And it was how two parties pledged themselves to each other. We exchange wedding rings and there's many other illustrations. You think of the king's ring throughout the Old Testament, how the king would take off his ring and give it to a person, and they would use that ring to dip it in the hot wax and then seal it onto a letter. It would be a symbol of the authority and the promise and the ability of the king to keep his promise. For example, in the book of Daniel, when the king sealed with his ring the letter, the law became absolute and could not be changed. It's when that symbol or that sign was used that there was the king saying, when you use my ring, that's an absolute that I will keep that promise and hold that law. And there's a lot of different symbols like that. I mean, some silly ones, but just think about some cultural things. You ever heard the term cross my heart and hope to die? When do you say that? You say that when you make a promise to somebody. I'll love you forever, cross my heart and hope to die, you know? Or whatever, you know, just little expressions. Here's another one that's a little gross, but you know, when you're about 10 or 11 boys, you'd prick your finger and make a promise to somebody. Maybe I'm the only weird guy that did that. Scott, you're about my age. Did you ever do that? Okay, all right. I mean, we have these things. And today, not today, 100 years ago, how did people confirm a promise? They shook hands. Business partners, what'd they do? They shook hands. Okay, how about you deliver 2 truckloads of wood and it'll cost $400, and they shake hands and say, okay, that doesn't do it today. Now it's got to be written down, you know, on a contract. But that's the idea. This is a sign that we are sealing the covenant and the deal. Back in Jesus' day, here's another one. Swearing an oath. I swear by the temple in Jerusalem that I will do such and such and such and such and such and such. And they made all these oaths. And Jesus talked about that once. He said, don't make your oath. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Again, Jesus was taking something that was going on kind of culturally. And he was saying, don't swear by heaven or by earth or by the temple. Just be honest and tell the truth. And always do what you say you're going to do. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. And one more that I'm thinking about, and that is, how today do we affirm our oath? We do it with a signature. You know, when you buy a car, you sign 24 times. You know, you buy a house. You know, how do you affirm your oath today? It's by your signature. No more handshake. That just don't do it anymore. But again, all these are sealing of a deal. It's the sealing of a covenant. But in ancient times, way back there, and again, we've kind of lost a little bit the culture of this, but way back there, even before, you think about this, before writing, probably before things were written down or just in some, I don't know exactly when writing started and when it could be used for agreements or covenants and relationships, but this was an ancient practice of the sealing of the covenant. And this is how they did it. They usually took a large animal and they cut it in half and they laid it out on two sides. So they divided the animal sacrifice into two sides, and then one or two person of the parties who would enter into the agreement would carry a fire and walk through between the animals. And when they walked through, they were saying that was the sign. And again, it's hard for us to understand this culturally. What would that do, you know? But then people might say, well, what's a handshake do if they're from Mars, you know, or any of these other things, you know? But they would carry a torch, and they would walk between the animals, and there they would seal the deal and the covenant. Sometimes it would be one person if it's a one-way type of promise or covenant. Now, this is, of course, when it was a big deal, and it was a cultural thing. Sometimes between kings, for example, or between tribes, when it had to do with the exchange of land or maybe other things like that. They're making promises, and they carry the fire in between the two parts. It was called cutting a deal. When you've all heard the term, they cut a deal. Where does that come from? It comes back from this ancient, comes back to this ancient practice. That's where the term cutting a deal comes from. It was cutting the animal, laying it apart, and walking through with a fire and promising you were cutting a deal. You were making, you were pledging yourself. And so you kind of think of that term of the cutting of a deal, and then you go back to verse 15 and read it in the context. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried. Go to verse 17, I should say. When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said to him. So Abram prepared the sacrifices, and Abraham waited till the moment that God appeared. God came down, and angel of the Lord, whoever it was, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, and it's now in the evening time, and Abram's been waiting for God to come and seal the deal, cut the deal, make the deal, make it absolutely a promise that could never, ever, ever be broken. That was the idea of this covenant ritual. It was to say, I will never, ever break my promise. And how true that is of God and his promises to Abram to this very day, the descendants of Abraham and the land that they live in and all the tumultuous things politically and militarily and world events and what's going to happen and how it's going to all turn out and how it's going to come to an end and is going to be in the next year, 20 years, 50 years, 1,000 years, million years, whatever. But it all goes back to this promise where God came through and the torch passed through. And on that day, God made a covenant to Abram. When the sun had set and God announced his pledge and his promise to Abraham. And as I've read about this, and I told you last week that I had a professor who talked about this, and I wish I still had my notes. It was so fascinating, interesting, reading some of the places in archaeological history where this ritual is described. But it was at nighttime in the dark. The sacrifices would be set up during the day, and then there would be a time of waiting, time of almost like saying, are you sure you're going to do this? Are you sure that you're going to make a promise and you're going to keep your promise? And then at nighttime, it says Abraham fell into a deep sleep, you know, and like all day he's waited, and then suddenly the time is right, and this torch just picks up and moves through. And God, on that very day, it says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham and said, and so at the time of the making of this covenant, there's also the speech is given, the promises are articulated, and God does that here. He passes between the pieces, and then he says to Abram, he tells Abram about what's going to happen. He says, Abram, this is the way it's going to be. This is the promise I make. The first thing he says to him is that, Abram, your descendants are going to be enslaved. I mean, you think of all the things that God's going to tell Abram. He kind of tells Abram exactly what's going to happen. Number one, Abram, is your descendants are going to be enslaved. Then he says, but they will be brought out of slavery, and then they will possess the land. And so he talks to Abram about the fourth generation, and God just in this covenant just tells Abram what's going to happen. They're going to be taken into slavery. 400 years later, I will bring them out. And you know, God brought them out to the day he said that he was, looking at another story from Genesis, how amazing that is. And they will possess the land. So this part of the covenant for Abram, you know, Abram died without seeing a whole lot of this covenant fulfilled. He really didn't, because, you know, he died into the fourth generation himself, and he didn't see the people possess all the land, nor did he see 8,000 descendants. He saw a lot of them, probably 200 or 300 or 400. I'm not sure. If you count all his family and all those things. But again, even the promises that God fulfilled in this covenant were not known by Abram in his life. And that's another thing about faith, is we still do not, even with the greatest of faith, we still do not know the timing of God and God's heart and God's plan. I mean, how could have Abram understood what God was talking about 400 years later? and all that would take place with the Israelites coming out of Egypt and the Moses and the law and the conquest of the territory and the displacement of the Canaanite people and all that being going back to this night when the torch passed between the animals. It truly is amazing and incredible to think about. All this, God is making a covenant. All this is God saying, this is what's going to happen. A fascinating part. Let me read the rest of that verse. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, to your descendants I give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates. So he says, wow, from Egypt to the Euphrates. Wow. Whew, that was a lot of land. It's a lot of land. To Abram, I mean, he was rich already. He had lots of cattle and sheep and servants and all that. But he kind of spells out how much from Egypt to the great river, Euphrates, and how contested that land is today in world history. Well, we may wonder, why this land? Why was this land so important? I've certainly wondered about that, and maybe you have too. Maybe you haven't thought about it. Why this area of land? Why did God promise Abram this land? Why not Ur of the Chaldeans? Or why not Haran that you see on top of the map? Why not go south or east or north or, you know, why not the middle of Russia? You know, what is it about this land that was so significant that God would make this promise? I've wondered about that. It could be a cradle of civilization, maybe, but we don't know because the Bible doesn't say that. But, you know, there's different possibilities. But I wonder if a key to that is in verse 16. And again, God's plan for 400 years later and 600 years later and 1,000 years later and 2,800 years later in the time of Jesus. And we read in verse 16, before then we read, go back to verse 16, in the fourth generation your descendants will come back here. Look at the last part of verse 16, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. The sin of the Amorites have not yet reached its full measure. There was something about the people that lived in this land that had God's attention. And it certainly would seem from world history and what we read in the Old Testament that this area was particularly wicked and it was occupied by people who were very, 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 very offensive to God. Not that we can measure one sin to another, but there's something about the promised land and who lived there during the time that God made this promise to Abram that would tell us that there was something moral about this land too. For the sin of the Amorites had not yet reached its full measure. There's something about the Amorites and their people and these tribes in Canaan that God says in 400 years it will be so bad that it will be time to absolutely destroy them. And you remember what God said to Moses and to Joshua, go in and destroy them. I mean, we struggle with that. How could that be right and fair? I mean, I do. I wonder how is it that God can tell Joshua, go and kill every man and woman and child and burn down their cities and destroy their fields and absolutely destroy them? I believe the only way I can really understand it kind of goes back to this verse and what God says here, the sin of the Amorites have not reached its full measure. There's something about the wickedness of man and the horrible stuff that went on among these peoples that absolutely God said, I have got to clean these people out. And this has got to be the cradle, the birthplace of the plan of God. And when I think about the sin of the Amorites, and there are many descriptions in the Old Testament of the sin of the Amorites, not called that everywhere, but called of the Canaanite people and how wicked they were in the eyes of God. And I think it's key to understanding how offensive they were and understanding further into the Old Testament, why did God tell Joshua to kill them all? And what happened when he didn't? What happened when the Israelite people did not do what God told them to do? How destructive it became, how horrible it became in the intermixing of religion throughout the history of the Old Testament, especially in northern Israel, but both kingdoms as well, and all the prophets and how they rail against the people and how they've taken on the gods of the Amorites. And
those things. And then at the end, you have
the writer telling us the names of 10 tribes, basically, that occupied this promised land that God says is going to be the land. Listen again to the name of them: the Kenites, the Canaanites, Cadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. Here we have 10 names of tribes, of people. All of them we read about later in the Old Testament, some more than others. Some kind of become kind of conglomerated into two tribes. But basically you have 10 tribes that are called out here. And God says, way back to Abraham, way back here, at least how it's recorded here, way back here, he says, God is bringing your descendants to the place to wipe these tribes out. That's the purpose of God. The fact that it did not happen leads to much of the pain of the Old Testament that took place there. But you look at that, and you look what God's plan was: the Israelite people to come in, and for the 10 tribes to come and to take over the land of these people and drive them out, repopulate the land under God's law, under the law of Moses, and to begin this process that leads to the Messiah. You notice 10 tribes of the Canaanites, and there are 10 sons of Jacob plus 2 grandsons of Jacob that become the 12 tribes of Israel. And some people have theologically talked about that the 2 sons of Joseph who became names attached to the 12 tribes. And so you kind of have 10 that occupied this area, now 12 occupy this area later on. But it was not without painful consequences when God's people did not do what God called him to do. But even in this covenant, God is giving this great promise to Abraham, probably very little of which Abraham could have understood about the future and what was going to happen someday. But it all goes back to that first time, the very first time that we read that God spoke to Abraham in chapter 12, verse 3. It says, the Lord said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. Go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. I think that's the key to it. Here God says, all the people on earth will be blessed through you. You won't see it, Abram. You won't see it in your lifetime, but I'm working over time. And the covenant begins, the Abraham's covenant that is so significant to our whole picture and understanding of the Old Testament and the story, a neat story.